So 1979, when we first appeared on the scene alongside The Specials, alongside Madness, alongside The Beat from Birmingham, and also UB40 as well, we were pretty much taking the old ska themes that had been around, like Blue Beat and Rocksteady, and we were mixing them up with what we had grew up with, which is basically rock music, punk music, and a bit of soul, maybe a bit of Tamla as well. So it was a bit like a mashup of all those things. And I guess that the selector probably veered more towards the reggae side of things than some of the others did.
Within your film, A Two-Tone Story, Don Letts, how would we describe him? The impresario, the filmmaker, the musician. He says that two-tone was this extraordinary, God-given combination of the danceability of ska and reggae music and the energy of punk. So is that really what lies behind the term two-tone, that it was this blending of cultures?
Well, you could look at it as blending of cultures, but I think you could also look at it in the way that, you know, it's black and white people together on the stage. I mean, it's not that that hadn't been done before with Eddie Grant and the Equals, but it was the first time that a whole generation had come along and chosen a music which took white rock music ostensibly and black music like reggae and like ska from before and put the two things together. I mean, we weren't the only ones who were doing it. I think that's one of the things that you have to remember about it. But I very much called it A Two-Tone Story, the film, because that's what I am. That's what I am. I mean, it's not just about two-tone. It's not just about the music. It is kind of how I came into this world, if you like, sort of a mashup of, you know, a white Jewish mother who lived in Dagenham and a Nigerian father who'd come over here to study in the early 50s and met my mother. And they had a child together, but he was then went back to Nigeria. I guess when two-tone came along, we were very much looking at it in terms of the iconography of black and white checks and the way that went together as a signifier. And if you actually look at the Too Much Pressure album, you will see that the guy on the front who's leaning against a wall because it's too much pressure is bounded by this black and white check on all four sides of a square album. Well, that was to signify, I mean, the way that we're kind of, if you like, the way the police treated us at the time, for one thing. And it was, you know, we were imprisoned in this, but we were making it our own.
As well as Too Much Pressure, there was in 1976 the film Pressure by Horace Ove, which was written with Sam Selvar, the writer of The Lonely Londoners, which looked at the first generation of born here, black people from the Caribbean, and the kind of pressure that we were under from the police, from unequal schooling, from unequal employment opportunities. Could you bring listeners back to that moment in the 70s when you were facing it? What did pressure feel like to you?
I didn't grow up surrounded by a black community. I didn't know who my parents were. And the family that I'd been adopted into were white. And not only that, they also had racist ideas. So it was very much a question of having to get out of that environment and into another environment. But then again, you're at a disadvantage because you don't really know the cultural heritage of the people that you wish to join. So you kind of get it from both sides.
Yeah. In the extremity of being, as you describe it, black and blue in Essex, you source to this experience some qualities in you, such as your ability to, as it were, withdraw into yourself, to kind of armor plate yourself against a kind of an external, slightly hostile, in fact, sometimes very hostile environment.
I heard all these racist tropes from quite an early age. And of course, that's quite confusing because I didn't know any black people. I seemed to look like the black people that they were talking about. That kind of gives you a rather strange idea, I suppose, of oneself. But I just knew they were wrong. I knew they were wrong from a very, very early age. But when I look back at it now, I consider that to be quite a privileged position. I didn't grow up attached to any culture in those terms. So it was a little bit like a pick and mix.
But now an absolutely kind of stratospheric thing happens in your life. You realise that you've got to get out of kind of monocultural, monoethnic kind of Essex. You go to Coventry, which is an extraordinary place and is the kind of the pulsing heart of two-tone culture. But what you find is a Coventry that had car manufacturing, that had kind of an industrial plant, but all of that in the stagnation of the 70s was closing down. But in the meantime, it had drawn into it hugely diverse working communities from South Asia, from the Caribbean, from elsewhere. So this for you was suddenly a discovery of multicultural, diverse Britain, but at a moment when it's going into a slump.
When I came here, there was still a car industry, but it was beginning to move into that whole kind of 3-day week, you know, Edward Heath, all of that kind of nonsense that went on, and Callaghan. So by the time I came of age in a band, Margaret Thatcher had just been elected, and that was in 1979. And that was a complete and utter sea change. That was really when Coventry went into a proper slump.
Yep.
And all the attendant problems then, which of people who were maybe the most recently arrived, of losing their jobs, losing their houses and stuff like that, began to surface. And I guess that's what two-tone, when that came onto the scene, that was indicative of that racial tension. We were mirroring that in the society that we were living in.
Within this particular kind of space that began to open up in Coventry, two-tone, the music comes. I'm just trying to dig down with you. What ignites it exactly?
I think when Bob Marley came and toured here, for one, I think when Steel Pulse brought out Ku Klux Klan and they arrived on Top of the Pops. Yeah. And I also think that The Clash began experimenting with reggae. And in, I believe it was 76, the rather wonderful white rock god Eric Clapton had a drunken rant on the stage at the Odeon in Birmingham, and pretty much used fairly vile language to say that Britain would be a better place if people who looked like me or you went home. If you put all that into a cauldron, that gave rise to rock against racism.
Somehow it's a music of a fight back, of defiance against that National Front, neo-Nazi, dark time that we were living through, enormously violently racist. That was its response to kind of social, economic stagnation, to become, as it were, kind of racist and blame it on foreigners. Your music did lead a kind of feeling that, no, we can stand up to this. We can fight this. Within the film, we see that sometimes, actually, you really had to be ready for a fight, because often racist National Front skinheads would come to your concerts.
It is quite scary if you're standing on the stage in Hammersmith Palais and you've got possibly the first 10 rows of people all Zeke Heiling at you as soon as you finish a song.
Oh dear.
Yes. And also what happened at Hatfield Polytechnic, which found us kind of, being herded into a room right at the back of the poly, because there was a load of skinheads who were intent on fighting and really kind of possibly hurting any black person that they came across. So all these things were character forming.
Having grown up with a white adoptive family in Essex, you describe yourself in the move to Coventry and the discovery of fellow diverse spirits as having found your family. Did you at the time ever feel yourself a leading voice? was around about this time that you changed your name from your adoptive family's name to the surname Black.
Mm-hmm.
You suddenly said, I'm Black. I'm going to be Pauline Black. Get used to it. This is now me.
I named myself Black, the main reason being my family would not use the word Black. I came of age when I was 15 at a time, if you like, when, you know, James Brown named a nation, the Black Nation. Mm-hmm. How people wish to subdivide and kind of call those things now, that's entirely up to them. Mm-hmm. I still hold quite dear to that because it's an identification that I chose.
Have you never encountered situations in which people have refused, Black people have refused your Black identity? How have you dealt with that?
Well, I mean, it is entirely their prerogative how they wish to see me. It is an identity that is mine, that I carry, that I hold quite dear. And
what it
come
means
on, when,
for
when
you.
We're meeting other people, what are the social signifiers?
Yes.
Right? The colour of your skin.
Yes.
What sex you decide that, what gender that you adhere to. Mm-hmm. What clothes you are wearing. What
yes.
car you are driving. How big your house is. They all have a bearing on what your identity is and how you are seen. There are people here with, say, parents who both came from the Caribbean and would call themselves Black British,
yes.
right? I would call myself Black British because that's why I named myself Black. I didn't want there to be this weird kind of thing adhering to me, which was, oh, that poor mulatto child. She doesn't know what she is. Aren't they sad? All those poor old mixed race people. Frankly, I'm bored with that.
Yeah,
I'm bored with that.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit like, I can invent myself.
Let's flip and look again at your performances. Of course, the whole two-tone style was kind of based on that sharp, suited look of people stepping off the Windrush and then kind of focused down onto two-tone and the black-white checkered thing. But you were always on stage in a kind of suit, a trouser suit, of some form or other, sometimes with a nice trilby. It was androgynous. That's male wear. And
well, of course it was androgynous. Yes. I mean, that was
you're inventing,
deeply thought
you're
about.
You're inventing a new relation to gender as well at the same time.
I think there were people who dressed in suits and women long before me. I mean, you know, Catherine Hepburn springs to mind.
Absolutely.
You know,
nothing new under the sun, but what was going on?
So there's nothing new under the sun, but I mean, my main thing was, what were the role models that I had at that time?
Yes.
They were Tina Turner in exceptionally short skirts and being the kind of, you know, the vixen, the kind of, you know, feisty Black woman and all the rest of it, which suited her perfectly. And she was absolutely amazing at doing it. I could not imagine myself doing such a thing. At the time as well, then there was Chic. There were the two women in Chic, and that was all very much kind of, you know, spandex and all those other things and weird wigs and things. And who else was around? Yes, there were the I3s. And these were women who were always backing up Black men. And I personally, I did not want that identity for myself. Somebody very interestingly in the film says, you develop this kind of armor and you occupy space. And any woman who decides she's going to occupy space, her own space, make her own space, walk like a man, you know, in the way that men occupy space very visibly, was, I guess, how I was looking at that and saying, here I am on stage, I'm going to occupy that space and you're going to listen to what I've got to say.
Can you tell us about the way the gender politics led to some of the difficulties within your musical career with Selector?
Well, the only difficulties were with other people, how they interpreted what you were doing. I mean, I invented the way that I was dressed, the way that I was presenting myself on stage. I suppose when I look back at it now, it was quite different to how other women were presenting themselves at that time. Yes. I did it not out of any gender politics way of thinking. I was actually feeling as though I was living it. Here I was on stage with all these guys, you know, one white, one mixed race as well, from Ghanaian parentage on one side and English on the other, and people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica. And, you know, we were all very forceful personalities. So it was more we were talking about our personalities, what we were bringing, if you like, to the stage, than we were talking about whether I was a girl or you know, I mean, that was their problem.
I want to draw back now because the career of Select was, I think, just slightly longer than a year, with endless number top 40s and number one hits.
Touring. It was 2 years, actually.
2 years. Touring in the States, in Europe. It comes to an end. Let's look at the afterlives of what you call a semi-famous person. You go into acting, you present on television, people know you, they want you around, but somehow they can't find a place for you. There isn't still a place for you, other than the one that you so spectacularly made for yourself for such a short time. Can you take us to that period of dealing with the afterlife of pop stardom, of being a music icon?
It was a strange time because I think, like I say in the film and the book too, that nobody prepares you for failure. Nobody prepares you for when an album that you put out doesn't do as well as what you thought it would. Mm-hmm. And you're having to deal with that. I mean, that's the music industry. It is always moving on, and people are always moving on in their tastes, in their music, in their styling, and all of that. And suddenly you find yourself not able to do that wonderful mercurial thing that people like David Bowie did. You find yourself really kind of at the back of the bus. It's quite strange to take that on board. Now, some people, they just go back to their day jobs. Other people go under, you know, drink, do all the other attendant problems that leads you to an early grave. I chose just to do other things. I rather liked the fact that I could try my hand at acting, just because somebody asked me, do you want to be in this? And I went along with it and actually took the trouble to learn how to do it. The same with TV presenting. These were opportunities that the 80s gave me.
Here we are, I mean, all of these years later, still writing books, still making films. How would you describe any shift in our culture to now?
To now? Well, I mean, there's obviously a lot more black faces on television. There are obviously a lot more black people that have moved into not just TV, but, you know, through sport. Those are the traditional channels of, you know, getting black people on television. But I see more people in, you know, producing, directing. I'm talking about the creative industries here. I don't know about other industries as such. I hope they're following suit. About the people that I see.
Yes. You say that you left acting because actually there weren't the parts, and actually there was no such thing as colorblind casting or color visible casting.
At that time.
There just weren't the roles at that time.
At that time, was the late 80s, pretty much.
Do you think it's adequate now? Adequate to the kind of demographic we have in our society?
No, I don't think it's adequate. You know, who could have dreamt that there would ever be someone who had the vision to see something like Bridgerton and make it successful, irrespective of what
American,
you might feel about
that's
Bridgerton.
That's an American TV show.
I know it one. Is, but I mean, I'm talking about how it was received over here.
Absolutely.
People love it. And I've always, probably because I don't necessarily feel... Or certainly when I was younger, didn't feel the kind of kinship with the black community in this country that I should have done. My kinship always veered towards the place where I could see black people visibly. And that would have been on the TV. You know, I grew up during the whole civil rights movement. So that deeply interested me what went on then. coming back to now, yes, there are more black people around. Yes, we do have directors like Steve McQueen, like Idris Elba, and they're getting into spaces that were traditionally white in that respect and doing the right thing, which is making content for people who look like me and you.
After this kind of heady height of pop stardom, you began to probe again your actual birth circumstances and discovered that you were a Jewish princess. Tell us a bit about that.
Now, you've actually used those words. Jane Mingay, the director, she is Jewish as well.
Yes.
Right. And so she was quite fascinated by that. And I said, well, I say it in the book and I wish to say it now because it kind of pops that bubble. Because, you know, there's no way that I feel like Nigerian royalty. That's what I found. But it's very much, I mean, in my book, I say that puts a whole spin on being a Jewish princess, which it does.
Of course, your grandfather was our Oba, our king in Oshobo. And your father was his eldest son. We used to call him Gordon because, of course, I knew him. The thing about Oshobo, I'll put it to you, is Oshobo is the artist's town amongst all of the Yorubas. Do you feel it's in any way surprising that you emerged as such a fierce artist?
When I first found out where I came from was a real, you know, not just a cultural heritage site, but I mean a place of the arts, I was fairly ecstatic about that. I mean, that really brought a whole new meaning, I think, to what I'd chosen to do, because it just came out of left field going into music in the way that I did. But I think there sounds as though there was an immense resilience among the people there to get their thoughts, their feelings, their ideas and sort of, you know, push them into that artistic place. I feel that hopefully I inherited some of that. Yeah. There's a whole load of people who look like me that, you know, my dad left behind or his brother left behind, things like this. So I've been, you know, finding them because a lot of them are either here or in one of the European countries. I don't know whether it's been conscious or unconscious, but I haven't... Nigeria still seems distant to me. The Yoruba culture doesn't feel distant to me.
The way that you put it structurally in the film, there was a kind of two-toning of moving between a Yoruba performance and your two-tone selector performance. I think, oh, well, that's very good. And on that note, Pauline Black, thank you for talking to us at Writers' Mosaic.
My pleasure.
Well, I can't recommend the film highly enough. Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story. It's from your perspective, but actually it really does tell the story of our generation.
Thank you, Gabriel.